have a forerunner, Jesse Scherer, in information science, who worked in the University of Chicago's Graduate Library School, who also suggested that the foundations of library and information science should be in social epistemology. The study of the social nature of knowledge and the nature of knowledge production. And he wanted to combine social epistemology and knowledge organization, social epistemology and libraries, librarianship. That was his main program already in the 1950s together with Margaret Egan. And Steve Fuller is mainly known for his work in science and technology studies, and lesser known for his exploration of the relationship between social epistemology and information science, which he has also done some very interesting work on, and that he will present to us today.
Okay. It's on? Everything's okay. Okay. Thank you very much, Sana, for inviting me here. Let me say something a little bit about my background. And because obviously I'm not a library and information scientist. My background is originally in history and philosophy of science. And shortly after I completed my PhD, about 25 years ago, I founded a journal called Social Epistemology. And at the time, I didn't know about Jesse Scherer's precedent in the field. Okay, but I think it's fair to say, and this is something that I learned maybe 5-6 years later, that Jesse Scherer, who is one of the leading theoretical figures in library and information science, was the first person to use the phrase social epistemology and to define it as a kind of field into which library and information science was especially relevant to speak to. Okay? And this has to do with the social production and distribution of knowledge. Right? That's what the field's about, social epistemology. And Jesse Scherer basically thought that, especially in light of the, he's writing originally in the 1960s, okay? And so we're talking about a period where the computer technology is just beginning to get on board as part of what librarians need to have as part of the way in which they mediate knowledge, right? So it's no longer just looking at books in a shelf, but in a sense being able to figure out card catalogs that may be digitized on a computer. Already Jesse Scherer was thinking about this kind of thing and what this does then to the idea of how we think about the organization of knowledge. And the point that I would make about this at the outset is that what Jesse Scherer is doing here, and certainly what I'm doing, is not in some way responding to a technological innovation that happens to have taken place in the 1960s and 70s, but rather in a way reminding us of what should be the point of having a field like library and information science. Okay? Because I do think sometimes, in a very stereotypical kind of world, maybe the kind of practical world in which a lot of librarians operate, you know, librarianship is about making sure you know where the books are that you happen to have, where they're located, so that people who want them can find them. Okay? And so in that respect, the domain of knowledge that one's concerned about is restricted to what books happen to be on the shelves, rather than the entire sphere of written, documented knowledge. Okay? And of course, this is when you think about what the difference that computer technology has made to librarianship. It's been the possibility of expanding what that sphere is, right? So, in other words, in principle, at least, and certainly, this is, you know, if you look at Google or any of the sort of major kind of internet providers and so forth that are around today, it's pretty clear that in principle the idea is to make available online all forms of knowledge, maybe at a price, but the point is to make it available, everything. And this is the challenge I think that Jesse Scherer was kind of pointing to with what was the difference that computer technology made in the 1960s. Namely, the possibility that if you want to be an adequate librarian, what you're mediating isn't just the books that happen to be shelved in the library where you exist, but what are all the possible information resources that are available online outside of a particular library, right, which then demands a certain a different way of thinking about what your task is. Okay? And I want to bring this forward because I think this is where social epistemology is philosophically interesting, right? Because here I am, a historian and philosopher of science, who goes into this field of social epistemology. I then later discovered Jesse Shera was on top of this issue, you know, whatever, 20, 25 years before I was. And I think I see him as a kindred spirit, right? Someone who's trying to move in the same direction. Okay? And I think this has a lot to do with, you know, as I understand it, the people who are in this room today are first-year students, and that there's a sense in which, what is the point of going into library and information science? And I actually think that in principle, and this is what keeps my interest in the field, I wrote the entry on social epistemology for the Routledge Encyclopedia of Library and Information Science, okay? So I have a sort of long-standing interest in this field that goes back at least 10 years. I was a visiting professor at UCLA in their School of Library and Information Science at that time. And I think that this is, in fact, potentially a very crucial field. And it's a very crucial field, especially for the university, okay? Because if you know anything about how universities operate these days, right, the incentives for producing knowledge are very much driven from the outside in terms of funding sources, in terms of client interests and things of that kind. And one of the consequences of that is that certain forms of knowledge tend to be accentuated and developed at the expense of others. And so then the question becomes, who are the people who actually know the full range of knowledge that's available, despite the fact that there are these different incentive structures around that say, you should be moving in this direction rather than that direction? Right? Who are the people who know, as it were, to put it in more primitive terms, let's say, all the books on the shelves, regardless of how many people take them out of the library? It's a library and information scientist. Okay? And so in that respect, it seems to me, insofar as library and information science retains this kind of perspective as its starting point, it will be the caretaker of what is universal knowledge, especially now with the introduction of the computer. This is where the introduction to the computer is very important, because in a sense, you no longer really need to think about just what happens to be on the shelves physically in the site in which you're operating. Right, you could start thinking, well, online we can get access to all these kinds of things, and how am I going to enable the people who are interested in getting access to be able to do so? And you see, that's a very important point, because you know, the point of librarianship in the first place, you know, if we go back to it, especially when it serves a kind of public community function in the 19th century, right, where you have public libraries emerging in various towns and cities, and this is very marked in the United States as well, it was part of, you might say, a way of, what do we call it now, lifelong learning, continuing education. Right? That was the function of the library, right? The people who because of an education system that figured that everybody ought to be literate, it's not just enough to be literate, they should be constantly, you know, replenishing, improving their literacy skills through reading and interacting with text, and the librarian is the caretaker of that, where the scope for expansion is potentially infinite. And this, in a sense, has been more fully realized with regard to the having the computer online stuff. Okay? I realize this is not how the computer online stuff has been interpreted in your field. It's not like I don't know this. But I'm giving you the normative picture, okay? The normative picture. That is to say, how things ought to be, how your field ought to be thinking of itself, as a proactive field moving into the 21st century. Because there, if you look at the way in which academic world works today within the university, disciplines are increasingly internalized, specialized, only focused on the things, you know, follow the money, basically, right? And what that does is it increases a pattern that had already been there within academic life, which is to say that 90% of the citations go to 10% of the texts. So what happens to those other 90% of the texts? Are they useless? Are they worthless? There is no disciplinary incentive in academia for actually reading those things that people don't cite very often. But see, here's where the librarian information scientist actually has a role, because they are the caretakers of what Don Swanson called 25 years ago, this great sort of information scientist at the University of Chicago, Don Swanson, if you don't know about him, you should learn about him, undiscovered public knowledge. Undiscovered public knowledge, and that's most of knowledge. That's most of knowledge, right? Because most of the stuff that is actually produced, that's actually written, that's actually validated by peer review sources goes unread and certainly uncited. And the librarian and information scientists are the only people who have, as it were, a professional interest in maintaining the existence of such things. And those things, in a sense, as they accumulate over time, are like the raw material. They are like the unmined ore of knowledge that could take us in many different directions from the ones that have been established by the narrowly plowed fields into which everybody is working in the various disciplines in which they operate. So there's this enormous amount of knowledge being produced that people do not read, do not cite, or anything. And nobody's really, it gets produced. There's incentives to produce it, there's no incentive to use it or read it. This is where the librarian and information scientist can come into play. Is to be the caretaker and to be the person who reminds the person who comes to you and say, I want to find out about this, that, the other thing. I'm interested in this problem, that problem. What should I be doing? Blah, blah, blah. Right? You should be the person who knows about the thing that the person within the fields in which these people normally operate don't know. So you should aspire to universal knowledge. Okay? You have an incredibly important role. And the reason why, when I was at UCLA, one of the arguments I was making, and I continue to make it today, is that the library and information scientists ought to be at the heart of university planning with regard to research, teaching, things of that kind. They should be right there as a kind of pro-vice chancellor, pro-rector, whatever, you know, right there in the management team of the university. Because insofar as the university still concerns itself with producing a kind of knowledge that is all of knowledge that is available to everyone in principle, then the library and information scientist is actually the person in principle who's best capable of doing that. Not people who are practitioners of specific disciplines, because they have their own vested interests, they're pursuing their own career courses and things of that kind. And that's why you end up getting this highly narrowed way in which academic disciplines have developed, certainly over the last 50 years. And of course, it's been in process longer, but the last 50 years is where it's been most pronounced. Okay, so I think that there is a real intellectual need for a serious library and information science profession. And this profession, as I conceive of it, is one that shouldn't just be alongside of all the other academic disciplines, but should be a kind of meta-discipline, a second-order discipline. A discipline that, as it were, looks at all the other things in particular that the disciplines themselves don't look at, but is out there. Right? And this is why I think it was a very important move to think of, you know, there's been this move within the field over the 20th century to think about the object of study of a field that might be called library and information science as documentation. Because documentation then just means anything that's put in a text, right? Anything that's written down, regardless of whether anyone uses it. Which means that it's always there as a potential to be used. Right, so you're not just looking at the actual books people purchase. You're not actually looking. In other words, it is a measure of knowledge as it's produced as an object, regardless of the use. And then the role of the library and information scientist is to make up the difference. Right, so we've got all this knowledge being produced, but it's not all being read. It's not all being used. And then who's going to make up the difference? Who's going to make people aware that there's this other stuff out there? It's going to be the library and information scientist. And very often what that means, and this is the tricky part of pursuing this kind of normative goal, is that you will be in conflict with the established authorities of particular disciplines. Because there is a reason why disciplines go down a certain kind of path, why they've developed in a certain kind of way, and why they've ignored certain kinds of things. And the reasons may turn on ideological issues, but may also turn on very specific kind of institutional issues about saying, well, you know, because these guys in an established department already do this, I'm not going to do that. And so people in my field who are writing about something that somebody in another department is already doing, I'm going to ignore. That could be a very local institutional decision. It doesn't have to be a big ideological decision. But the point is, the library and information scientist is the person who has a universal compass, who in principle could say, look, you're ignoring this stuff, and this stuff may well be relevant, even if it conflicts with the disciplinary boundaries and all the other kind of protocols of the field in which you happen to be normally operating. Okay? And this is, to me, what makes library and information science a very exciting field. Okay? And one of the reasons why I think you guys have credibility at the outset on this kind of matter, I mean, is because you people are concerned about the materiality of things at a certain level, right? You're concerned about documents, books, where they're located, right? There is always a material reference to what's going on. There's always stuff that becomes kind of the focal point. And the question is, how do you organize the stuff? And on what principles you organize the stuff. Now, I say this may be obvious to you who've gone into this field, but if you think about it, most other academic fields are organized primarily on conceptual grounds, in terms of ideas, in terms of theories, in terms of explanation, not in terms of stuff. And this is one of the reasons, to be perfectly honest, why library information science isn't regarded so greatly in the academy. Because you guys are just concerned about stuff, right? You're not concerned about ideas, right? So you're not concerned about what is the economy? What is, you know, society? You know, what is physics, right? You're concerned about books. You're concerned about items that have been written, items that have been documented, things you can track, things you can trace. You're a very evidence-led field in that respect. Okay? And what's been interesting from the standpoint of the history of this field is the technological developments that have changed the way in which you've conceptualized the stuff. Right? So it's no longer just physical books, but it can be items you can access online, which may be accessible in some other university or whatever. But it's stuff. It's not ideas. And this is one of the reasons why you guys are regarded in a very low status. Because all other disciplines are organized around ideas. And you guys are not, I mean, regardless of the fact that you call yourselves, you know, information science, right? Information is not an idea that actually organizes the field. It's more like a slogan. Right? So information can be anything, right? And you don't own it either. That's the important point too, right? Whereas if we're talking about the economy as an idea, which of course everybody uses in ordinary language, economists own it. Right, so you may talk, you and your with your friends in the pub may start talking about the economy, but whether you know anything about the economy will ultimately be determined by whether an economist says you know something about the economy. Okay, so whereas with information, you don't own it in that way. You don't own it. It's like, oh my God, what would the leading information scientist have to say about what I say about information? Right? I mean, you guys know that no one would take that seriously. You know, it's not an issue. Because the field is not organized around an idea. It's organized around stuff. Things. Matter. And this is why technology has made such an important difference to your field. Because technology reorganizes matter in a very obvious way. Changes the modes of access, availability, etc., etc. And so then it becomes incumbent on you to figure out, okay, what's my relationship to this? And I think there is a guiding idea there. There is a guiding idea there. And it's largely an idea that other fields have had in the past, especially philosophy, but has been abdicated by those fields. And this is the quest for universal knowledge. Right? Philosophy was supposed to be about universal knowledge. Theology, back in those days, was about universal knowledge. And those fields, for various rather different reasons, through different means, have abdicated that kind of thing as what they're promoting. But you guys are actually the caretakers of the stuff that we regard as bearing knowledge. So in a sense, you're the natural home for this project of talking about universal knowledge and how one thinks about it, and thinking about whether, for example, whether we are in fact accessing and using all the knowledge that is potentially out there available by virtue of the fact that it's already been produced. In other words, it's not something we're speculating about, right? This is the stuff part can help you here, right? Namely, we actually do have books and journal articles that actually do talk about the things that need to be talked about. It's the problem is nobody's reading it. We don't need to commission more research. Okay, now that's an interesting angle on the argument here. Because as you know, one of the ways in which people measure academic worth these days is by whether you have large research grants where you're doing original research, right? You're going out there in the field and you're just testing things that nobody's ever done before, and you get lots of money for this and so forth. And that's presupposed on the idea that no one's done this before. And now you look at it, you know, again, I say this as someone who referees research grants for many different councils in many different countries, right? You're going on, you know, when people have to make a judgment on the question on the grant application form, has this research been done before? Is this sufficiently innovative? Blah, 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 right? Those kinds of questions routinely get asked in the thing, right? The people who are answering those questions, people like myself, have at best an impressionistic knowledge of whether in fact anything's been done. So basically, if I haven't heard of it, it hasn't been done. Okay? I don't have a professional interest in knowing everything about the field. So as a matter of fact, and I think this is really true, that we end up commissioning a lot of surface, very persuasive research that gets funded by research councils, but basically are reinventing the wheel. Because people didn't know what's already been published. Now, I'm saying all this because, as you know, we live in neoliberal times, right? Everybody has to sort of justify themselves in terms of the utility that they provide. And here's something that I'm suggesting with regard to library and information science. Namely, that you guys should be the people who all the grant agencies have to go to figure out whether this stuff's been done before. What are the precedents? You guys should be experts at the very least on that sort of matter. Okay? Because there are a lot of people who are very clever, who come up with all sorts of ideas. And because they're ignorant of history, they're ignorant of the past, they don't realize this stuff's been done before, the results are already known. If you're going to do a study of this kind, it has to be improved in a certain way, you know, in order to really make any kind of progress. You are the guys who know this, because you are the guys who know about the undiscovered public knowledge. You are the guys who can access that stuff. And you can say, well, you know, this guy's got an interesting idea, and yes, this idea isn't very popular nowadays, but in fact, 25 years ago, somebody was doing this, and they made this amount of progress on it. So if this guy wants to continue that idea, he needs to take into account that research. You people should be the people saying that. Okay? At least as long as we have academic specialization, where people who are working within specific disciplines are just concerned about what the leading edge of the front, research frontier is within their own fields. They're only going to be focused on where everybody else is going. It's kind of like sheep, right? Everybody, they just sort of follow the herd. It's a herd mentality where everybody follows the top 10% and the rest of them get left behind. But you are the guys who will be concerned about the people left behind and say there might be something very important there. And so when research grants proposals come across that actually propose these new things, you can connect it up with the past. And frankly, I think this actually saves money. Because I have to say that even, you know, within sociology and so forth, there's an enormous amount of reinvention of the wheel. And it's basically on a generational basis, right? Because one of the things, I mean, and you know, each individual researcher is operating for a certain limited period of time. They are born learning a certain amount of stuff in PhD when they're doing their PhD or they're in graduate school. And that turns out then to form what they do for the rest of their lives, more or less. There are a few people who actually break frame and do different things. But the point is, you know, what you know when you're age 25 or 30 is pretty much what determines what you're going to do for the next 30, 40 years. So that means a lot of stuff will be just routinely ignored. Because if you're not part of what people are learning in the curriculum at that time, you're going to be, you know, no matter how much you publish, you're going to be ignored. So the question is, who are the people who are going to recover that stuff? Because that is undiscovered public knowledge. That is stuff that may, in fact, be perfectly good, especially if they got into peer-reviewed journals. The fact that they're not cited, right, is an open question why they're not cited. There is a tendency, I think, in the scientometric literature, bibliometric literature, to think that if something's not cited, it's worthless. No, what if it's not cited, it's obviously not trendy. Right, that's the only thing you can conclude. It's not trendy. Doesn't mean it's worthless. The fact that it got through peer review, in a sense, should be a kind of validating marker and might lead you to think, well, maybe there's something there, right? Actually, after all, you know, it got published in the same journal as all this other stuff that got cited so much got published. Do we not trust peer review? If we do trust peer review, then we should think that, in fact, the products of peer review are being underutilized. Right? So in other words, one doesn't have to be a kind of radical who says peer review is rubbish, though it may be rubbish in some sense. But the point is, you don't have to hold that view. You can just look at the fact that within the peer review process, a vast range of things pass, very few of which ever get cited and promoted. Okay? And I am, you know, and my view is, and I think this is the view that the people who are in library and information science should take, is that this is just fashion. That academia is given to fashions just like everything else is, and there's a lot of very good stuff out there that just gets ignored because it doesn't fit into the trend, and the trend can be determined in various ways. It could either be determined academically within, in terms of like a Kuhnian normal science, you have a paradigm, everybody thinks the same way and they move in the same direction. You can have that kind of way of being fashionable, or the fashionability can come from the outside in terms of what the funding agencies think is attractive at a given moment. But what ends up happening is 90% of the stuff that even if it passes peer review and gets published and is documented, etc., gets ignored. Okay? And so the library and information scientist is in a position, because they are concerned with the stuff, the fact that the stuff was published, right? The very fact that the stuff was published, the fact that the stuff is out there, the fact that the stuff is cataloged, it's classified, that they are in a position to recover that and bring that forward, right? In these critical moments where we're making decisions about in which direction the research frontier ought to go. Okay? So I have a very strong kind of positive, proactive view about library and information science, and I think that the current computer technology enhances that in a way, because it allows you access to more things than you ever had access to before as a librarian. But the key thing, and this is the thing in terms of, you know, among the many skills that you might learn as a librarian in information science, is what is the key skill? The key skill that I'm talking about here is judgment. Judgment, right? In other words, I think it's a real mistake. And I think this is a point, the point I'm making now is one that's been remarked many times before, and it's one of the reasons why librarians are being replaced by machines all the time. right? Namely, if all you're doing is doing a readout of what the computer tells you, right, then we don't need you, right? We're getting smarter and smarter search engines. We don't need people to manifest pluralism. Machines do that really well, and they're going to do it better in the future. Really. We don't need the... Pluralism is something a machine can do. This is the thing. People who have this image of machine as deterministic, monolithic, dead wrong. No, machines are about pluralism. Do a Google search. You get pluralism immediately. What you need is discerning judgment. You need the kind of, you know, in the art world, one talks about connoisseurship. Being able to tell a good painting from a bad painting, a good, you know, this is what you need in librarianship, okay? Because this is what the computer is not going to give you. So you need to think about what is your value added as a practitioner from all of these fancy technologies that are going to become more and more impressive over time. They're going to give you lots of results, lots of things, but what they won't give you, at least as far as I know, and they're certainly not aiming to do that at the moment, is a discerning judgment. The kind of judgment that an art critic can give of artworks. This is the kind of level of, you know, intellectual acuity that you should be aspiring to as a librarian. What is a good or bad, which way, what should you be looking at if you really want to move in this direction? Okay. Now you notice, I'm making this analogy very deliberate because connoisseurs are typically not themselves great artists. They're people who buy art usually, right? They're people who purchase art for others. They're the people who populate the stuff that's in museums, curators, right? People of that kind, right? Those are the people who are the connoisseurs, right? They know a good stuff, good thing from a bad thing, and that's the stuff they purchase to put up there. That's the kind of role you guys should be in with regard to knowledge generally. That's the skill. That's the thing the computer will not replace. So the computer opens up an enormous horizon where you can take up the role as being the caretaker of universal knowledge. But the only way in which you can do that is by not reproducing what the computer is providing. You need to have some sense of discerning judgment. Now, you might say, oh my God, how can I do this? I'm just a librarian. I don't know anything about physics or philosophy or blah, 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 right? Well, the point is, look, you either trust the tools of your own field or you don't. Okay? Because information science has, over the years, developed very sophisticated ways of classifying and organizing information. There are lots of different ways of doing this. I don't consider myself an adept in any of this, but I know it's out there, and whenever I look at it, I say, ah, this is very good. This actually provides a shortcut. There's some shortcuts that one can, you know, if you are able to organize and classify material carefully, where one doesn't need to know all the detail of what actually is happening in a particular experiment or a particular field study or something like that. But there are certain kind of markers, as it were, in the text, that if you know them, you can make judgments about whether this thing is just following the trend or whether it's breaking new ground and whether it's relevant to the client that happens to be consulting with you. Okay? So draw on your own field. You actually have some good resources there. You need to trust them, and they provide you with a certain kind of expertise. A kind of expertise that the people who are in the first order disciplines don't have. That is to say, the people who are doing whatever, the things about which you're documenting, right? So the physicists, philosophers, humanists, whatever, those people, they don't have the knowledge that you have by virtue of seeing the patterns in their textual formations. And that's your distinctive role, it seems to me. And if you really embrace that role and you push it forward as a kind of professional identity, I think you potentially have a very strong role in reinvigorating the university in the 21st century. Because at the moment, the university is losing its sense of internal cohesion. Okay? As in particular, as a place where, as a site of universal knowledge. And it seems to me the library and information scientist is in a very good position to revive that kind of ideal within the university structure. So I think I will stop here. I've been speaking for about 45 minutes, I've been noticing, and open it up to questions. Is that okay? Okay, well, thank you very much, and we're being filmed here. So when you ask questions, I may repeat them just so people hear them clearly. Okay? Okay, we'll begin. Yeah, yeah.
But, okay. I have a question, because this seems like a great idea. But how do you think it's possible to get the universities to realize our capacity with these questions? Because it seems like this field are being neglected in some way. And I feel that that's a big problem.
Okay, so the question is, how do we get the university to recognize that library information science is as important as I've been suggesting in the talk? Well, I think you need champions. You need champions within the university who actually believe this idea. Okay, that's the first point. So, you know, whoever happens to be the person who speaks, you know, so if we're talking about it at a local level, that's important. I think one problem that library information science has run into is that it's somehow embraced this role of being a service provider, where in a sense all of the issues are coming from the outside, and the library and information scientist becomes a kind of bionic technology. And this is why I think we see, in fact, a lot of librarians being replaced by computers, right? That phenomena where you're getting technological displacement of librarians comes from the fact that librarians, in a way, have for too long seen themselves as service providers, and the service provider model presumes that the client always knows best. Right? The guy who comes to you wants certain kinds of answers, but you don't feel you're in a position to say, well, wait a minute now, have you thought about the problem this way, that way? Aren't you looking at things too narrowly, etc.? I don't think the librarian has really felt that they can kind of engage with the user that way. You see, I mean, I think there's an issue about the self-image as it's being promoted across the university of the librarian. The librarian is seen as a service. If you're a service provider, you're like a janitor, basically. Really, be serious. No, I'm serious. You have to assert yourself as an academic discipline that has a certain kind of expertise that is not had by other academic disciplines. And it is a second order expertise, which is to say, it is a very deep and important expertise that you have. Because in principle, if you know all of these various ways of organizing forms of knowledge, in principle, you actually do have better access to what's actually out there in the field than the practitioners do. You really do. And you need to take that seriously. I don't know, you just have to think about a diplomatic way of putting it. But the point is that you have, this is, you know, if you really want to be a real serious, this is, because there is a real thing for you to do that isn't being done by anyone else. But it isn't just figuring out, you know, where is the book I'm looking for? Right? That's where the computers, the technological displacement of librarians shows the failure of the imagination of this field to come to grips with what it's about. It shouldn't be displaced. Especially in a period of academic specialization, where everyone is getting increasingly narrow, more narrowly focused in what they're doing. The academic specialists, as we often say, know more and more about less and less. That should be the market for the librarian to fill in the gaps. But that's not happening. But it should happen. Intellectually, it should happen. The great minds of the field, people like Jesse Sherrill, they knew Don Swanson, who I mentioned earlier. The great minds of this field know this. And it should be taken on board as part of the professional training. I mean, because one of the things that I worry about a little bit, and you know, if you look at the, you know, when I was teaching the curriculum at UCLA, the guys like Shera and Swanson and other people, and at the end of this month at the ACIST meeting, the American Society for Information and Science and Technology, I'm going to be doing a kind of a plenary session that has to do with the anniversary of this anthology that came out, which maybe you don't know about. It's called The Study of Information, Interdisciplinary Messages. And this came out in 1983, and it was edited by a very important economist, Fritz Machlup, M-A-C-H-L-U-P. Enormous book, lots of important people, including Jesse Shura, involved in it. And all of these people are pointing to the idea in the 1980s that information science will be the core discipline of the future. For reasons more or less like I was saying, right? Namely, reflecting on the fact that there's greater academic specialization, there's going to be somebody, we're going to have the need for people who know how to put it all together. We have all this new technology coming on board that's computer-based that will enhance our ability to do this. So in other words, enhance our ability to search all the various things and come up with connections that the practitioners themselves may not see, rather than just reproducing what the practitioner could figure out if they actually knew how to operate the search engine. This was in 1983, okay? And I think this is a goal that's still worth striving for, but of course, all of these guys like Swanson and Shara, one of the people who was one of the younger people involved at the time, who's a sort of a kind of gray eminence, at least in part of this field, Boyd Rayward, he was involved in this. You should have a look at this book if you haven't seen it before. But there, I'm not inventing this ideal, okay? This ideal was seen as a kind of a natural outgrowth of thinking about increasing disciplinary specialization, the advent of computer technology, and the need to still be able to access all knowledge, right? Because the more knowledge that's available to more people, the better the human condition will be. And here, the information scientist is in the perfect position to do that, circa 1983. Okay, and this is what social epistemology was about, and I still endorse this kind of idea. But obviously, the field is not developed in that way. It's developed in a much more parochial, modest kind of way, kind of deferring to the authority of the disciplines, all this kind of stuff. Very unfortunate, actually. But there is an enormous amount of intellectual potential here that if you rethink what the field's about. Because look, if you don't do it, what's going to happen is we're just going to get a larger and larger amount of undiscovered public knowledge. That is to say, more and more stuff's being produced, more and more stuff's being published, peer-reviewed, etc., etc., and fewer people are reading it. Right? That's what's going to happen otherwise. And so what? And of course people say, well, this is just all a waste of time, all this knowledge is being produced, nobody reads. Well, but why is it a waste? It's only a waste of time because disciplines develop in a way that are very narrow-casted. Right? Very path dependent. Once a certain idea takes hold, people follow it until it dies a natural death. That's in fact one of the lessons of Thomas Kuhn's theory of paradigm change and the structure of scientific revolutions, right? Paradigms self-destruct after they exhaust themselves, but only after they exhaust themselves. So in other words, a lot of stuff that was going on at the same time that wasn't part of the paradigm gets ignored. But it's still there, you can still find it. It's documented, right? This is where you guys come in. It's documented, it's there. It's just nobody's looking for it. That's why it's undiscovered public knowledge. And that's what you should be about. Yes, you had it.
Yeah, I was just wondering, you talked about citations as being the criteria for what is regarded as qualitative knowledge.
Yeah.
And we are to go away from that. What tools do we have to discern what is quality when it comes to knowledge, this undiscovered knowledge?
See, my view is actually all of the bibliometric, scientometric indicators that we use now are fine. It's just that we don't interpret them the right way. You know what I mean? So in other words, I have no problem with saying X gets cited so much and that the field is being narrowed in a certain way. Because there's the facts, right? They're the empirical facts. And I actually think that scientometric, bibliometric data actually tracks what people are actually reading and citing better than anything else we've got out there. The question is, what are the normative implications of that? Right? And I think the tendency has been to think, well, if something is cited a lot, it's the right thing. It's the good thing. We should all be following it. Or even if we don't agree with it, it's the thing we should be dealing with in some way. Okay? And I'm saying that's not the way to interpret it. I think the way to interpret the fact that, whatever, 90% of the citations go to 10% of the works, is that there is a kind of path dependency, as economists say, and this is institutionalized through ways that I think are pretty understandable from a sociological standpoint, because students who want to become accredited in particular fields have to know specific texts in terms of which then they define their own identities. And those texts are ones that get into the curriculum. So if you look at the reading lists, you can pretty much figure out, you know, the stuff in the reading list tend to be the highly cited stuff, right? And that then organizes how the students think about their own research projects, and then they move that way. So I don't think it's mysterious, okay? I don't think it's like an invisible hand, blah, blah, blah kind of thing. I think it's pretty straightforward how it happens. And maybe in some sense it has to happen that way, I don't know. But the point is, the library and information scientist, by virtue of having access to the documentation on everything, and in a sense, in principle, treating all documents equally, you might say, you know, let's say before we know the citation counts, we're interested in classifying them and organizing them and everything, you're in a privileged position in a way in which a disciplinary practitioner is not, to be able to make those judgments. And so what I would say is, the way to interpret a lot of those, you know, trending kind of scientometric, bibliometric measures is to say that, yes, institutionalization, routinization, the way in which people are trained, are moving them in this direction, and they're exploiting it to the maximum. They're doing exactly the kind of thing that Thomas Kuhn did talk about as what you do in normal science, where you take a paradigm and exploit it to the max. But that's all you're doing. It doesn't represent all the knowledge that's available in the field. It represents that particular form of knowledge that then gets reproduced and developed. It's as simple as that. But the point is, there's a lot more out there. In fact, an enormous amount out there that can be very useful. Yes, you in the back?
Yeah. So you're saying that we're like the people who know how to look at things and to know how to search.
Yes.
But like every people know how to search for things.
Like, no, but this is the point.
Yeah, they do.
But they don't have the universal perspective. With regard, because look, you guys, presumably as information scientists, you understand something about the principles of classifying materials, right? If I'm a user using Google, right, I don't know how Google organizes stuff. Presumably you guys as information scientists, one of the things you do study are the various ways in which things are organized. You have a kind of second order knowledge that the user does not have. And the question is, what does that then enable you to know? See, in a sense, you may be understanding the kind of knowledge you normally get in a very conservative way. You may, in fact, know more than you think. This is my point, right? And that these various ways of organizing and classifying knowledge may, in fact, give you insights into things that people aren't, that the average user isn't normally even thinking about, but may nevertheless be relevant for what the user wants. That's the kind of thing I'm talking about here. Okay, because I'm presuming you actually do learn something in information science that goes beyond just knowing how to use a search engine well. That you're something more than just a good user, right? You know something about the code, at least in a general kind of sense. You know something about the principles by which searching takes place. And that is your advantage. Yes, sir, in the back.
Yeah, so you're saying that there should be like a cultural gatekeeper.
Yeah, something like that, yeah. Cultural gatekeeper, this is what the gentleman said, yes.
In a sense, as a starting teacher.
Yeah.
Yeah, and there's a lot, you know, of course there's a lot of risks and problems with considering that, when you consider how society works in the practical sense. And I think, what can you see in that sense, the problems when we have the power?
Yes. Okay, this is a very good question.
Commercial.
I understand. No, I understand the thrust of the question. So the idea here is that this kind of universal role that I'm proposing for the information scientist amounts to a cultural gatekeeper, but then there are all these issues that arise with regard to the context in which such a person might operate, right, and it might be commercial in particular, right, various ways in which the function might be captured by a kind of client, right? Because it's not just universities who hire a library and information scientist, but also corporate clients, et cetera, et cetera. That's a really good point. And what I'm going to say about this is once you take this role seriously, you need to have professional ethics that are oriented toward that, okay? Because that is a serious issue, okay? And it speaks to the autonomy of this field, right? Because look, if you guys are really something like a liberal profession, right, you should have a sense of professional ethics. And professional ethics, and the outset, what it should address at the outset is your own autonomy. The sphere of your own autonomy as a professional to be able to speak freely about things. Yes, there's responsibilities to clients, blah, blah, blah. Yes, there's all that. But the first thing, if you're talking about a code of professional ethics, is you should be concerned about what it is that ensures your autonomy. Because I think this is kind of what this issue boils down to here, right? If you're working for a commercial client, you know lots of things, you know, you might end up telling them, well, you know, there's this research out there that says the kind of drug you're trying to pursue is rubbish, right? I mean, there's always that possibility, right? And if you're the information scientist, you may be in the ideal position to say that. Well, you should be allowed to say that, okay? And this is where I think in a course regarding, information scientists as professionals, right, what the code of professional ethics should be, this should be very much front and center, okay? Because you cannot be this kind of universalist that I'm talking about unless this is clearly understood at the outset. Otherwise, you'll just endlessly be compromised. And, you know, and I know that information librarians and information scientists, you do have codes of professional ethics, but they're sort of geared to the sort of level at which you're expected to be operating. And what I'm suggesting is, you know, raising your game a little. That you're a lot better than you think. Must be other questions, come on. We got time. Yeah, if you in the back, you want to ask him?
Yeah, I was thinking about this problem about more information, more knowledge that is coming right now. And it seems like sometimes there's a problem between the construction of the knowledge resources, this knowledge system, like Google and stuff like that. It seems like a really hard task to be a librarian and information scientist to understand all these systems, because they are getting more and more and more stuff like that. So it seems like this is going to be the main problem in the future.
Okay.
How
to deal with that?
Yeah.
Okay, so the question has to do with Google and all these other search engines are becoming more sophisticated, complex, and how is the library and information scientist to cope with this in the future? My view about this, the first point to make is if it isn't happening already, people in your field ought to be engaged with those guys, right? In terms of at least knowing what they're doing. I mean, if information scientists aren't involved with the Google people,
they are, but it's like so many systems and so many things.
I understand. Well, look.
So in the field, when you're working in the field, that can be a problem. You say, if you work in a library and you see all this new stuff to search for information.
Okay.
It seems like an enormous task to know all these systems, because it's like, you're only human.
No, I know, you're only human, yeah. Well, look, I mean, one thing I would say, and this is a kind of it's a sort of general sketch of a response that I think is worth thinking about, is, and so I'm going to give you a historical analogy here for a moment, so just bear with me. In the early 19th century, if you think about where all of the knowledge, all the new knowledge, interesting knowledge, productive knowledge was being produced, especially if you're in England, it was being done by the mechanics. It was the Industrial Revolution, right? New inventions, all this kind of stuff. Stuff wasn't happening in the universities, right? The universities were not involved in any of this kind of stuff in any kind of direct way. And so then the question becomes, if you're, you know, let's say a professor at Oxford or Cambridge at the time, where all the stuff you're learning about, you're teaching students, has to do with the humanities, right? What do you make of the fact that we, you know, we have the steam engine and the, you know, and all these other things that are coming out in the Industrial Revolution? The mechanics colleges that had sprung up, you know, in a way could teach people how to do the mechanical things, but then what good is a university? How does it relate to all these things that are sort of happening very quickly and changing the landscape of the economy and the culture and so forth? And the answer that came out, which turned out to be a very successful answer, was that you need academics to accredit the stuff. So in other words, how does Google know it's come up with a good or bad search engine? Now, you might say it does so because of the people who use it, and that's just a sufficient normative indicator in its own right. In other words, you let the market just... Google, I take it, Google basically operates with a sort of market-led sense of normativity, right? So in other words, if it works, if the users use it, etc., that's normative enough, right? It means it's good. It means it works. Now, academics, especially people in your field, would have a somewhat different perspective, because you would think about, well, is everyone, every potential user, not just the actual users who actually log on and do the searches, but all the potential users, are they getting access to all the potential knowledge? That's a different normative question than the question that Google is asking for establishing whether its search engines work, okay? That other question, the academic question, is the question, you know, one of the things you can start to say is, this is the standard by which we should measure the effectiveness of a search engine. Not just whether people like it, whether a lot of people use it, whether, you know, not just those market-driven things, where, as it were, the customer is always right, but rather some sort of larger sense of thinking about what is all the knowledge out there and who are all the potential people who'd be getting access to it, and is that actually happening? So in other words, is it sufficiently democratic in that sense? Universal and democratic. And that could be the role that the library and information scientist plays, namely thinking about that question in relation to what people like Google are doing. Because the Google people are always going to be in the best position to develop the newest technologies. They're going to come up with the most complex search engines, etc. But what you guys can do is analyze the data, right? And what are they considering successes and so forth? There may in fact be a lot of people being left behind through the increasing improvements of the search engines, right? The kinds of knowledge that's actually being accessed may be relatively limited, and large forms of knowledge may in fact remain inaccessible because of the way the search engines are being constructed. This is something that you guys can come in on. Okay, so it's not that you have to be a competitor to Google. You're not going to be developing a better search engine than Google does, but you can be their most effective critic. Okay, and you can be the people who say at the end of the day, in an authoritative fashion, whether the Google search engine is really good or bad. Okay, and you should try to gain authority over that kind of discussion, because at the moment you don't have it. Nobody has it, in fact. Right, and that's why all of this stuff that has to do with the way the internet operates is so market-driven. It just has to do with whoever puts forward the next technology ends up, you know, basically dominating the show. There is no academic normative input, really. And this is the position that you guys are potentially in. Yes, there's someone back here. Yes.
Yeah. Okay. It's easy to say that we should do it, but not like how we should do it. Users don't know that we can do it. You know what I'm saying?
Well, look, okay, I understand that how do you establish this kind of thing? I do think this is an issue of professional identity, no doubt about it. So this is the kind of issue that ultimately ought to be taken to your professional society and how you credit people in your own field and so forth. But I do think it would be useful for people who are prominently placed in your field to actually make some strong statements on this point. Okay? And to actually have people regularly do rating services of search engines and things like this, okay?
Publish them.
Yeah. And make this part of the academic research agenda in a way, right? And think of, you know, so in other words, you know, because I think it would be very powerful if a leading person in this field sort of trashed a popular search engine. You know, for the reasons that only relatively few people use it, or maybe a lot of people use it in absolute numbers terms, but in terms of relative terms, it's skewed in terms of certain white, male, Americans, whatever, okay? And doesn't in fact take on board everyone, and the kinds of things that are being accessed is also relatively limited, and this has to do with something about the biases that are built into the search engine, okay? These are the kinds of things I think it's very important for academic professionals in this field to be talking about. And this is where you develop, I think, paradigms and templates of judgment, right? This thing, the connoisseurship, right, that I was talking about earlier, right? That the connoisseurship can come in the form of saying, what's a good and what's a bad search engine? What makes a good a search engine better or worse? Right? We don't really have any kind of academically established standards on that kind of stuff, okay? And I think this is something this field could colonize.
Yeah, but if we would, we wouldn't need ourselves.
That's not true.
If we developed a very good like search engine, would we need information scientists?
No, because of the particular needs that particular individuals have, okay? And also at the end of the day, the goal isn't, because look, everybody has to be given a certain amount of space within which to search for things, right? But I think the sort of thing that can be published as critiques of search engines is in terms of whether a relatively few number of people, no matter how large the number, but relatively few proportionally to the whole population are accessing it, and the scope of the knowledge they're looking at. I think that kind of critique can be published, but that doesn't remove the need for the librarians and information scientists as persons. What it does is it's critiquing the technology. Yeah.
Well, what you talk about, the kind of, if I understand right, the paradigm, you mm-hmm. know, when kind of a discipline kind of self-dies.
Yeah.
Isn't that what this does as well? Because what we do is we look for information, we kind of look, as you say, we are the expertise on what we actually can find, and what we actually find is noteworthy. And when we've done that, what comes next?
No, but look.
If you don't understand what I mean.
Yeah, I mean, look. The difference between the perspective of the information scientist and an academic professional on a given area is that because you might say it's the advantage of breadth over depth, right? Because in a sense, I don't want to stereotype it, but my guess is that if you're a library scientist and you take an interest in, let's say, sociology. But as a library scientist, you'll be interested in the general patterns and the distribution of interest in various topics and things of that kind, and you will tend to take all that stuff sort of on board equally. You won't have, as it were, a commitment to having to pursue a particular trendy way of looking at things, right? Because you're not there, right? But you have a general kind. Now that's a different perspective from, let's say, the sociologist who comes to you and asks for advice. Because that person is going to think very narrowly, very focused on what the issues are, and part of what you will do is to say, well, look, there's this kind of broader horizon there that maybe you're not seeing. You see, that's kind of where I imagine the discussion, and that would not be replaceable. You see, that it's that discussion that would not be replaceable by the computer, right? And this is where I say the information scientist has this second order knowledge, because in a sense, you're sort of above the disputes that take place in the particular disciplines. You're not just trying to service those disputes, you're above them, right? So you're not below them, right? I mean, the problem is I think the library information scientists sometimes think they're sort of below the people they're talking to. You should think of yourself as being above them. And that would be, in fact, more true to what, in fact, your domain is, which is this entire sphere of knowledge to which then you add these principles of organization, classification, etc. Okay, that's the way I see it.
The thing is that you're kind of questioning the whole kind of...
Yes! Well, this is why you... No, but this is... Okay, you're absolutely right. It's a rhetorically difficult thing given the state of library and information science now.
Yeah.
But this is where you need professional champions. You need people who, in a sense, are saying, no, we're better than this, right? And I think it's not... The facts that justify... a higher status for library and information science aren't that hard to put on the table. Because we do have a very hard question to face. Got 90% of the stuff published, only 10% is, you know, is uncited, only 10% is cited. What do we make of that? Is that 90% useless? Is it really useless? No, of course it's not useless. But then what happens? Disciplines, if left to their own devices, are just going to continue going in their own direction. So who's going to correct that? Who's going to provide a corrective on some kind of regular, reliable basis to try to ensure, to at least a certain extent, that all of the knowledge out there is used? The undiscovered public knowledge, again in Swanson's term, right? To make sure that is used, who is going to ensure that? It is going to be the library and information scientist. And that needs to be adopted as a kind of professional position of the field. That you're a corrective. You're not an under-laborer, you are a corrective to the excesses of disciplinary specialization. That's a really important point. Yes, sir.
Yeah, so if we are to promote this new kind of professional identity, is there anything else besides the skills of judgment and our knowledge about, what do we say, about classification and stuff that we need to learn? What else do we need to learn in order to establish this role?
Well, look, I mean, I think there are two answers to this question. So what should be the education of somebody who wants to pursue this kind of normative ideal for the field? The first point I would say is, and maybe this is already true of people who are in this room, there are a lot of people who are very interested in certain kinds of fields, but for some reason don't really have it within themselves to do front-line research in those fields, but like to read about it and actually read quite a lot about it and read across and stuff like that. In a sense, that's a very desirable feature of somebody who goes into a field like this that I'm talking about, right? So it has to be a person who actually likes these fields, who has a kind of feel for the fields, but for various reasons, and to my mind perhaps quite justifiable reasons, do not want to get into a research career where they have to specialize in a very intense kind of way in certain areas, okay? So having a first degree, let's say, in one of the regular subjects is kind of useful in that respect. Where you know, but what you're interested in is actually reading across the field and seeing there's all this interesting different stuff. It's just way too bad there are no PhD programs that are willing to encourage that, right? Because I'm sure that's one reason why a lot of people go into this field, in a sense. Okay. The other thing I would say is that that in the history of philosophy, okay. If you look at there is an interesting kind, I mean, and this article or book or whatever has not been written yet, but there's an interesting kind of symbiosis between certain developments in the history of philosophy and the history of librarianship. And some of them have been documented within your field, but it would be good to have a kind of more use, because look, when you look at the revival, well, let me start with this. You go back to Plato, okay? And you look at the Republic, and you look at the education of people, right? Even though this was about the curriculum officially, what it was also about was about how you organize knowledge, the order in which knowledge should be had, what people should know, etc. Same sort of thing in Aristotle, the Middle Ages, Thomas Aquinas, all the medieval people, same sort of thing, right? Order in which things should be known, right? Often talked about in temporal terms as part of a curriculum, but ultimately a conceptual thing about in what order should we organize knowledge. And when you get into the early modern period, if you look at Leibniz or Kant and the German idealist tradition, clearly what these people are about classifying forms of knowledge and talking about how they relate to other forms of knowledge and so forth. You move into the 20th century and you get sort of the guy who's considered sort of the great theoretical founder of documentation, Paul Otlet, who some of you may know about, O-T-L-E-T, he's a Belgian, Otlet, O-T-L-E-T, he's quite a prominent person in your field. He was someone who actually wanted to, you know, who clearly had the kind of idea I had, and had this kind of universal system of documentation, okay? this guy was very closely connected with George Sarton, who was the founder of the field of history of science, okay, and who also had similar kind of bibliographic, kind of documentary interests as well. And he was a Belgian too. I mean, there's an interesting kind of story to be told about that, about Ghent as being a significant place. But then if these people end up having a lot of significant interaction in the 1920s with the logical positivist movement. Okay, so the logical positivist movement, international unified, you know, encyclopedia of unified knowledge. Again, it's about how do you classify knowledge, in what order should things be put forward, all of these kinds of things which are classically philosophical questions. What is the most foundational form of knowledge? How do you build on knowledge? These notions do resonate in the history of library and information science in very explicit ways through particular people who happen to be involved. Sometimes they're the philosophers themselves. So Leibniz, for example, was the librarian to the Duke of Hanover. Okay, so he had both roles. David Hume was librarian to one of the big chief justices in Scotland and Edinburgh. Okay, so some of the philosophers actually were librarians. Okay, but some of the others had very close kind of relationship. And I think that should be part of your education too, right? That in a sense, this is not a new role or a strange role or a role that you fall into by accident because nobody else has it, but rather it's one that's very deeply enmeshed in the history of the field. Okay? And I think it's important then that the history and the theory of the field be told that way so that you feel empowered to take that on board as part of what you should be doing. Okay, so that would be my answer.
Well, in regards to your first part of your answer,
yeah.
I think a lot of people, at least here in Sweden, that study library and information science come from some sort of humanities background,
sure.
Comparative literary art, stuff like that. So do you need to broaden the base for like the students? Do they need more knowledge in specific fields and not just this concentration in humanities?
Well, look. I mean, that's an interesting point. I mean, I know. Librarianship already is already, in a sense, kind of specialized as well. I mean, I think that the first point. I'm not saying that, you know, anyone who gets a degree in library and information science should be able to offer advice about what specialists in any discipline don't know about.
No,
right, because it's not like, you know, if it's so hard for those, you know, if specialists only focus on 10% of the stuff, and there's so many of them around, and there are only so few of you around, you're supposed to be focusing on the other 90%, right? That can't be applying across all disciplines, right? But certainly within the fields that you're familiar with, because look, even in the humanities, there's a lot of stuff that's, this 90-10 distinction that I'm talking about where, you know, 90% of the citations go to 10% of the things that are published. This is more or less true across all the disciplines. It's not just in the natural sciences, okay? And so having breadth across the fields that you are familiar with is useful. I mean, I talk to people in other countries, and they're actually in a lot of other countries. You find that natural scientists often end up in the library and information science field for the kind of reasons that I was suggesting in my remarks, namely that the research frontier seems too narrow, too competitive, too specialist. They don't want to get involved in it. They hear what it would be like to actually be these front, and they don't want it. But they still love the subject, right? They still love the subject. They love it in its entirety. They don't have, as it were, partisan views about who's right and wrong, but they know they're interested in the whole thing. And see, those people ought to be going into library and information science. Okay, because they're the ones who can then bring up the stuff that the specialists would not otherwise be paying attention to. But I don't think you need to know every discipline. I think, you know, within your own field.
Of course not, but I was just thinking that based for the actual program.
Well, I do, see, I do think there is a value to actually being very well read in the field, in a first field. Yes, I do think there's something to that. Because in a sense, the kind of task, the kind of role that I'm assigning to the library and information scientist requires that one realizes kind of what I'm talking about, right? So in other words, you have to be someone who has an appreciation that there's all this knowledge being produced out there, but relatively little of it is ever utilized, and tends to be in a very focused kind of way. I mean, you have to be someone who kind of knows that in some sense, who kind of, within your field, who kind of sees that within your field, and as a result, sees a role for yourself as in some way compensating or complementing that. Yes, sir.
Should libraries evolve into becoming publishers themselves?
Wow, now that's a... Okay, this is a question. Should libraries turn into publishers? I know this issue is a live issue. Well, let's put it this way. This is a brilliant question because in a way it addresses the professional status of this field, okay? At the moment, this would be nightmare. You wouldn't, because the field has such low state. I mean, to say something's published by the library of the university doesn't mean anything. Right? So in a sense, the answer, if I'm giving you an answer right now, I'd say no, never. Right? But if you have a scaled up version of this field, right? Because remember, what I was saying earlier about the role of library and information science within the university was it should be part of the central planning of the university. It should be what the university is about, right? It should be right there and be recognized as such. If it had that kind of status as a sort of pro vice chancellor sort of status, then yes, then it would matter. You see what I mean? Then it would matter. It would be something more than just a vanity publication. Because I think at the moment, if you say that a university library publishes something, you know, unless it's Harvard or Chicago or somebody like that, then it sounds like vanity press for the academics who are involved. That's what it looks like. You know, because, and that reflects the status of library and information science, I would say. That saying something is published by the library doesn't mean much. Because a library just stores stuff. It doesn't do anything creative or interesting with it. It just stores it and organizes it in the lowest possible way. So I think you really do need to have you need to upgrade professionally the field so that the whole idea of having Uppsala Library as being the stamp on a publication matters. Yes, sir?
Wouldn't it be, as I said, a natural involvement for all these small publishers to, instead of trying to independently work it out, they can find themselves working on this big organizing tree of a library who works, you know, it takes over the whole.
That's a very good idea, actually. I mean, so the proposal on the table is that given that I'm proposing that the library and information science person have this kind of cultural gatekeeping role, wouldn't it be incumbent on the library to try to incorporate a lot of smaller publishers and publish under its imprint? And that would be a great idea. In fact, that proposal is very much in the spirit of how I was responding about the Industrial Revolution issue. Because in a sense, what universities can do very well is to give a quality assurance to something, right? Once they're recognized as providing it. And I think once the library is seen as part of what provides quality assurance to the university, right? I mean, in other words, part of what makes Uppsala University a strong university is the fact that it has strong people in its library and information science who are the ones who say that the sort of stuff that we publish are good things, and they should be the people behind that. Okay? And so I'm 100% in support of that as the way to go. But you need champions for that. And it means that that the library information science person has to be taken seriously as having skills that enables it to pass quality judgments on things. But I agree with you. I think that's exactly the very proactive way to go. Yes?
Yeah. How do you look on the difference between public libraries and university libraries?
Okay. So the question is about the difference between public and university libraries.
In these questions.
Yeah, no, I know. It's a tough question. I mean, if you go back to the early 19th century, especially in the United States, where you had all these public libraries developed, to put it crudely, very often they were endowed by philanthropists who were the great industrialists who basically wanted working class people to become literate, to be schooled, to improve their human capital, as we would say now, so they would be better workers. Okay, and so the idea was for self-improvement. It was a sort of vehicle for self-improvement. And that was the spirit in which they were operating. And so very often within the library, you'd actually have what we might call nowadays lifelong learning classes taking place and things of that kind. I think that's very good, right? And there's a sense in which public libraries ought to be utilized in that way, and maybe even in a more active, proactive way, because a lot of public libraries in the United States are being closed now. Okay, and it's happening in Britain as well. But that seems to me that original kind of idea of what the public library was about is an idea that needs to be reinvigorated and promoted. Okay. Now, in the case of the university, see, the thing about a university that makes it a little bit different has to do with the scope of the knowledge that one should be concerned with. Okay. I mean, I think in the case of the public library, one is concerned about knowledge that is needed or useful for purposes of enlightenment, for being self-empowered citizens, for being autonomous and so forth. It's not clear to me that the public library has a remit for universal knowledge in the sense that a university does. See, the university has a somewhat different and in a way a tougher mission, where the university, in a sense, if you're a student, see the difference, because you have to sort of think about what's the difference between being a student at a university and being someone who just goes to the public library a lot, right? Especially if the public library gives lifelong courses. What's the difference? What difference does it make to be a student at a university? And I think the answer from the library standpoint is that the librarian is the caretaker of universal knowledge, making that available. You know, and not just available in the sense of making it easy to find, but making people aware that it exists, right? Because I think that's the big challenge. Most people who go to universities, including, and most people who teach at universities, don't realize how much knowledge there is out there. Again, undiscovered public knowledge. It's most of it. Most of it is unused. Okay? And I think that this is something that where the librarian and information scientist has a very distinctive role in the university culture. Other?
Okay, if there are no more questions, we thank Steve Fuller for this very, very inspiring lecture.
Okay, well, thank you very much for your questions.